You're listening to the Monocle Daily, first broadcast on the 14th of March 2023 on Monocle 24.
China responds predictably to the AUKUS submarine agreement. Striking Parisian rubbish collectors ruin the romantic getaways of the unimaginative. And would you hand in a sack full of money you found on the train? I'm Andrew Millett. The Monocle Daily starts now. Hello and welcome to the Monocle Daily, coming to you from our studios here at Midori House in London. I'm Andrew Muller. My guests, Terry Stiastny and Simon Brook, will discuss all the day's big stories, and we'll have an excerpt from Monocle 24's fine new travel programme, The Concierge. Stay tuned, all that and more coming up right here on the Monocle Daily. This is the Monocle Daily. I'm Andrew Muller, and I'm joined today by Simon Brook, freelance journalist and communications consultant, and the political writer, Terry Stiastny. Simon and Terry, welcome both.
Hello.
Hi.
Terry, I believe, well, I know for a fact, because we were just talking about it beforehand, you have been at some fancy media quiz to which Monocle wasn't invited.
I'm sure I can sort that out. I'm sure there definitely should be a Monocle table. Yeah, it's a big annual thing. It's a big charity function, and it is mostly a place for people to partly do a quiz, partly have quite a lot of wine, and mostly just compete ridiculously with each other and heckle their sort of journalistic rivals and try and show off.
So
we didn't win.
Well, but we can, I'm sure, all agree that Monocle absolutely would have won had we been there. So if whoever did win is listening, know that your victory has an asterisk next to it. You didn't win. How much did you not win by?
We were in the respect of, I think we were about, like 10th out of 40, something like that.
Okay.
Yeah, and high up. We're to the bottom.
How rarefied a standard of question are we talking about? I'm just
not. You see, Monocle, the only downside of Monocle, it would be the answers would be too rarefied, because it would be things about, like, you know, British TV and things like that that some of you would be really good at. Some people might be going, where are all my questions about, you know, other parts of the world?
Was there a question you were particularly satisfied to have answered?
Yes, it was about which was the Prime Minister who got in trouble, which wasn't Boris Johnson, who got in trouble for partying. And I knew that one because it was Sanna Marine.
Hey.
I knew that one.
She didn't get in that much trouble, though. She didn't have to resign.
I just knew her name, and I knew which Prime Minister it was of which country.
So. That was the main thing. I think a lot of us were impressed. She was a pretty good dancer for a Prime Minister, wasn't she?
Simon, you, I believe, are writing about the concept of 15-minute cities. Are you going to expose the ghastly World Economic Forum to imprison us all in our homes that the 15-minute city is?
Do you know what? I don't know, it's difficult, isn't it? Because on the one hand, I would like to do it, but on the other hand, do I really want to give these people publicity? These are the people who believe it is, as you say, some massive conspiracy.
Are you saying it isn't, in fact, that?
I think it's just a nice idea about having shops, restaurants, whatever you want, healthcare on your doorstep, and being deprived, I suppose, of the right to sit in traffic and breathe fuel-filled air. But yeah, no, apparently
want us to think.
Oh, absolutely. God, I'm so naive.
Where and when will people to be able to read this, you know, overt shilling for the global plutocracy?
Yes, for my fellow plutocrats. It will be in a supplement produced by a company called Raconteur in the Times early next month. So in a couple of weeks' time, it will be going out. And yes, it will probably fuel the conspiracy theorists.
I'm just now trying to think in my head what sinister acronym Raconteur could be, anagram rather, Raconteur could be turned into. What are they trying to tell us? I do like that thing about how these sinister, furtive global conspiracies always put a few clues in.
Yes.
Just so angry lunatics on the internet can figure them out.
The in crowd who spot these things, not like the rest of us fools.
Anyway, we will move on to the subjects at hand. And yesterday's announcement of the new deal on nuclear submarines struck between Australia, the United Kingdom and the United States was not altogether a surprise. It is, after all, the cornerstone of AUKUS, the Tripartite Defence Pact announced in late 2021, which was altogether a surprise, especially to France, which thought it was supplying new submarines to Australia rather than the US. The point being that China, against which AUKUS is clearly a bulwark, has had a while now to formulate a response and has duly declared itself aghast, specifically denouncing the AUKUS allies for, quote, walking further and further down the path of error and danger, unquote. Terry, the path of error and danger sounds like a deeply unappetizing fairground attraction. But is this reaction from Beijing any more or less than we might have expected? I think they're rather phoning it in at this point.
I think it's, yeah, it's fairly restrained. I mean, they're sort of talking about a Cold War mentality and, as you say, the path of error and danger. It's not any kind of a threat. It's like, you know, we sort of think we don't really like this very much, but there's not an enormous amount that we are actually going to be able to do about it. I mean, it's looking ahead into the, you know, there's so many sort of strange expressions that people are using in these kind of discussions, like, you know, Britain talking about having an Indo-Pacific tilt, which just always strikes me as such
that
a...
That sounds like a another unappetising fairground attraction.
Yeah, it's like, like in the Indo-Pacific tilt.
Yes, yes. I enjoyed the path of error and danger. I'm now going to go and queue for the Indo-Pacific tilt.
I think
tilt.
They won Oscar. They're nominated for Oscars.
Simon, the Cold War mentality accusation was levelled by China's foreign ministry spokesman, Wang Weibin, who also went off about a potential violation of the non-proliferation... Why did they call it that? Why did not call a treaty
spreading
something easier to pronounce? You know the one I'm talking about.
Yeah, that old one. Yeah.
Does he not understand, or is he pretending not to understand, that what Australia is acquiring is nuclear-powered submarines, not nuclear-armed submarines?
Yeah, the Joe Biden and indeed the rest of the leaders were very clear on that. That's very important. I think what's interesting about this and certainly, you know, China's response is, let's face it, there's a country, or you're not really allowed to call it a country, are you? But I'm going to do it anyway. That is not mentioned in not Australia, the US, or the UK, and that is Taiwan. I mean, that is really what we're talking about here, isn't it? And China has made it increasingly clear that they would like reunification, and of course, Xi Jinping has also removed that word peaceful approach to unification with Taiwan. So I think obviously that's, you know, one of the main sort of prompts for the West about this. Interesting as well that China accuses the three allies here of trying to use containment, which actually is exactly what this thing is about. I don't think there's any apology here. And, you know, China's muscular wolf diplomacy is the reason why this has come about. So I suppose we are sort of entering perhaps Cold War territory. But interesting to see as well how that was just East versus West, wasn't it? Whereas we've got US and the UK and Australia versus China. We've got Russia into the mix. We've got other countries like Iran that would also like to destabilise things, North Korea. So the kind of, I think the Cold War was very much binary, wasn't it? One side against the other, which kept us in this mutually assured destruction balance, whereas we're not in that territory anymore.
No, we are not. Terry, China's response, though, does also make me wonder. It's the question nobody has yet put to Wang Weibin, was, is as opposed to what? Do they expect other countries with an interest in the Pacific not to bother defending themselves or ensuring themselves against what China or indeed other threats might have in mind? It seems like a weird thing to get wound up about.
It does. I think, you know, particularly raising the nuclear non-proliferation issue is just try to, I think, just get world opinion generally to react to something that isn't necessarily there, to try and say, you know, oh, you should be worried about this. Perhaps it's a breach of a treaty, when, you know, just looking beyond the surface of it shows, you know, that it isn't. Yes, we should probably be more concerned about what China is doing, perhaps, you know, looking the other direction as well, you know, moving, talking more to Russia and, you know, trying to come up with alliances there. But it's kind of unclear where the balance is in terms of how Britain and other countries, European countries, are seeing China at the moment. I mean, when the UK put out its sort of refreshed strategy yesterday, it was saying, well, China is an epoch-defining challenge. But the sort of form of words is so vague. I mean, we've moved a bit from the kinds of things that Liz Truss has been saying in when she was briefly Prime Minister and since she's left, where she was really talking about the economic threat and having economic NATO and all these kinds of things. But, you know, they still, despite, you know, a lot of looking into this, haven't really set out in terms of what people see the challenge of China as being.
Well, indeed so. Simon, just a final thought on this. There is some talk, weirdly, or it may just be people amused by the potential acronym of France overcoming its dudgeon to actually sort of pile in on this, which would make AUKUS Fraucus. Which is kind of close to fracca. Well, it nearly works as fracca. Fraucus, no, I like fraucus, but is there an argument for that, that this is sort of a, I don't know what you would call it, an adjunct or annex to NATO, perhaps?
Yeah, it would be a sort of fraught caucus, would it? Caucus, that what it is? Yeah, I mean, I think
if Canada joined, it would be literally caucus.
Of course, it would be. You'd be there, wouldn't you? Come on, Canada,
pleasing,
help us out on this one. No, I think what's interesting about, obviously, France's nose was put out of joint, as you said, with this deal. I have to, and it's also, of course, what I think is interesting here is two things. One is, I think, I can imagine Emmanuel Macron will be very interested in joining. You know, I know he said that he, after all, said that NATO was brain dead a couple of years mm-hmm. ago, wasn't it? And then, of course, NATO is very much to the fore after the situation in Ukraine. But I think he would like to get involved in this because I think he would like to see France, you know, striding the world stage. And France has always been quite sceptical anyway about NATO. So this would be another opportunity for them to demonstrate their world view, if you like. I think also, let's face it, he's halfway through a second term of the presidency. I don't think he's going to go for another one. He's so young. Does this help with his CV to take some, you know, international diplomatic role or something? And I think the other thing that's interesting about this is how we're seeing what's sometimes known as variable geometry. So we're getting these smaller, agile groupings together. You know, we've got, for instance, Macron's European political community, which brings non-EU members, such as the UK, into a sort of Europe-wide forum. And this is another example of that. So obviously, we've got the big monoliths, you know, we've got the EU, we've got NATO, we've got the UN, but then also perhaps within that, we've got these sort of slightly more, as I say, agile security or trade or economic groups as well, which also, you know, about sort of mutual interest.
Macron is term limited anyway, I think I'm right in saying, which may be why he's just enjoying himself now. There will be more on this in tomorrow's edition of the Foreign Desk Explainer. Subscribe now to avoid disappointment. But sticking with the subject of President Emmanuel Macron and France, he is discovering, as all French people are, especially in Paris, that there is nothing quite like a strike by public sector workers for reminding everyone who does the actually useful jobs, which is, of course, part of the point of strikes by public sector workers. However, even within the realm of strikes by public sector workers, no industrial action is quite as bracing a reminder of the importance of a particular trade as a strike by rubbish collectors. Several French cities are currently experiencing just such a thing, part of ongoing protests against President Macron's plans to raise the retirement age to what would still be among the lowest in Europe. As of yesterday, it was estimated that 5,600 tons of rubbish, but who counts these things, was reeking uncollected on the boulevards of Paris alone. Terry, it is amazing, and the footage is extraordinary and slightly terrifying to anybody but Parisian rats who are having quite a high old time of it. But it did make me think, given the incredible leverage that rubbish collectors have, it's kind of amazing they don't do this more often. I mean, I don't understand why they don't just go on strike all the time wanting £1 million a year.
I think, depending on where you are, I think they do. I mean, I think if you look at Rome, I mean, you know, there's constant arguments about who collects the bins and this kind of destroys political careers. And so, yeah, they have got, you know, quite a lot of power here. And they basically, but they are striking about having their retirement age raised from 57 to 59.
It's slightly lower for rubbish workers.
Everywhere else will have to work in France till 64.
But, in recognition of the physical difficulties attendant to the job. But just to follow that up, Terry, are you genuinely sympathetic? I'm not saying that collecting the rubbish is not a hard day's work, but at 57?
No, I mean, I think this is a hangover from like the old French system where there used to be sort of set retirement ages for all sorts of professions. Like, I think if you were a ballerina, you could retire at 35, or an engine driver, you could retire at 40. So these are things that were set in law such a long way back. And now it isn't, you know, the kind of strenuous job that it used to be. And it also assumes that, you know, once you're a refuse collector, that is your entire career for your entire life, which I don't imagine is probably, you know, it's probably necessarily, even in France, sort of, it's not like a profession that you're going to stick with for your entire career. So, you know, I think Macron is trying to, I think he will get this through. I think a lot of people in Paris are playing all sorts of politics about it. They are, you know, trying to, you know, the government is trying to blame the mayor of Paris, who's, of course, the socialist. And, you know, people are thinking about the next elections, which are quite a way off. So, you know, it isn't just about bins. It's also about, you know, national politics and trying to compete on that front.
Simon, on that subject of the distribution of blame, which is usually the background to any highly visible strike, what is the way forward for any government faced with this? This is leaving aside the question of who is right or wrong here. Is their best hope to ride this out and hope the public blame the strikers rather than the government?
Well, that's always the way, isn't it? And we've seen that in the UK with the strikes here. To what extent does the sympathy, if you like, as you say, tip away from the strikers when actually we've had enough of them and they become less appealing? I mean, I have to say, it did make me laugh when I read this because I just thought, in a way, I mean, bins and pensions in any country, mm-hmm. really, but certainly France, you couldn't get a more toxic mix. So you put the two together, no wonder it's terrifying. I have to say, apparently, for every person living in Paris, there are 1.5 to 1.75 rats. Well, making the City of Life one of the most City of Lights one of the most rat infested in the world. So, yeah, probably not a good.
I mean, possibly more. The estimate I read was 6 million rats in Paris. But whenever I read those things, a bit like the 5,500 tons of rubbish piled up in the streets, who is counting this? And could the person counting the 5,500 tons of rubbish
not pick up a few rats? What if the rat catcher's gone strike as well?
Exactly. Then we're really in trouble.
But on that subject, Terry, and let's assume that there are a lot of rats in Paris, as there are in any big city. Is there an actual serious argument here that an irresponsible risk is being taken with public health?
I think this is largely people making political capital out of it because, you know, Anne Hidalgo said, I completely support the striking workers. She is trying to use this partly to put pressure on the government. They're all looking ahead. You know, hopefully the bins have been collected before the Olympics start in a year or so's time.
500 days from yesterday.
People are trying to get, 500 days and sort of 500 more tons of rubbish. it will get cleared up eventually. We don't know how long the strikes are going on. They're due to run for possibly another week. And, you know, a lot of the heat is going out of some of these protests as the law gradually goes through all the stages of the French Parliament to get passed. And people may not like it. It is probably going to happen.
Well, on the subject of people not working, we will look at the UK now, because here, as elsewhere, we're probably still several years away from understanding the full impact of the COVID-19 pandemic, which incidentally is still hospitalising several thousand people every week. But we have learned something of the dent it has put in the UK's workforce. There are now at least 500,000 working-age British people classed as economically inactive than there were before COVID-19 struck. This does seem to be a strangely British phenomenon. No other wealthy country has seen anything like it, and possibly not coincidentally, no other major Western economy is predicted by the IMF to shrink this year. Simon, first of all, this is fun for me as a non-British person, because I do get to sneer at your compatriots as a nation of work-shy, bone-idle layabouts.
That's me.
Yeah, where have they all gone?
Well, as we were saying before we came on air, they've gone to the Tate Modern to look at a Cézanne exhibition on a Wednesday afternoon rather than sitting in an office.
Was the Tate Modern crowded on Wednesday afternoon, Simon? Was that what you discovered?
When I went there, in my research for the programme, or they're out in the golf course, or they're out, perhaps they're doing voluntary work somewhere, I don't know, but I mean... Yeah, I think the problem is the assumption with this suggestion that in tomorrow's budget here in the UK, the Chancellor will try and change pensions or whatever, introduce some reforms that will provide a sort of economic incentive, if you like, to get people back into the workplace, older people back into the workplace. I don't think that's the reason that's going to do it. I mean, I think, life is comfortable for a lot of people. And this is obviously one of the aftermaths of the pandemic, isn't it, where people suddenly realise, actually, you know, I'm okay really financially, and sitting at home and doing or not sitting at home doing my own thing is pretty good. So I think that's probably the reason why the government is struggling to get people back into work. The other reason, I have to say, less amusing if you like, is ill health. You know, between June and August last year, around 2.5 million people reported long-term sickness as the main reason for their economic activity, according to government figures. That was up from 2 million in 2019. So yes, some older people are having a great life or whatever, but a lot of people can't work, would like to work, just because they're ill and the health service hasn't been able to cure them or at least get them back up on their feet and into work again.
Terry, of this 500,000 of economically inactive people, and I do wish they would come up with another euphemism, that sounds really quite dismissive. But roughly 300,000 of them are aged 50 to 64, which, if I've done my maths right, would put them at roughly the age where they could have bought property in the 1990s when they were in their 20s,
exactly.
And therefore have probably done quite nicely. Is that a large contributor that people are now just basically living off their home?
Yes. I mean, I think, you know, as Simon was saying, there are two sorts of problems here, and the way that the government is approaching this is not necessarily going to solve either of them. As you say, we've got sort of an age bracket of people who have probably got, you know, pensions that their companies paid into that will pay out relatively early. They have probably paid off their mortgage. They have probably been working quite a long time and may not have to worry about that quite so much. But then there are the people who are in poor health and people who, you know, are seriously not, you know, able or haven't found a way to get into work. And they're trying to solve them a different way. Like the health problem needs a completely different type of solution. And some of the things the government have put forward saying, well, let's have health checks for people who are at work. Well, again, you're not targeting the right people because the people you need to target are not at work. But also it's a public health issue, and perhaps probably something that for that bracket of people you needed to start 20 years ago in terms of, you know, exercise, lifestyle, those kinds of things which might enable people to be more active. And, you know, obviously if there's some more serious health crisis, that's a different matter. But you've got to try and think about it in the round. And, OK, it might work to say for a doctor who can't pay any more into their pension and therefore has been told it makes no financial sense for you to work. That might get some people back into the workforce in the short term. But this is not really a long-term solution that is going to help a lot of people.
I mean, is it arguable, Simon? I'm not talking about the people who are economically inactive due to illness. And as you correctly point out, there's a lot of them. But those people who we've been talking about who kind of embraced lockdown as a sort of early retirement and just thought, you know, took stock of their lives in the way that you suggested and thought, actually, you know what, I'm probably all right. Should the government be trying to encourage them, or should the government be thinking more about younger people who are struggling more obviously because they didn't get to buy property in the 1990s?
Yeah, absolutely. Well, I mean, one thing I would say when you were talking about it, I just thought, I know some people who are in their late 50s, 60s who would like to work, but actually there's unspoken age discrimination. Of course, it does cost more to employ these people. So actually, they might be trying to do it, but companies don't necessarily want to take them on board. But yeah, there's always, and this is the complaint, isn't it? There's always this focus on the older people, the boomers, which has almost become an insult these days because, as you say, they're so economically comfortable. But it's the younger people who are struggling with childcare. Don't forget, that's a massive reason for people not going to work. They're struggling to pay their mortgages, especially as mortgage rates have risen. Thank you very much, Liz Truss. So really, perhaps these are the people who just need that, that extra help to get them into the workforce. The other question that this all raises, of course, and this is very difficult for all governments, especially the Tories as well, is immigration. You know, if you can't get the homegrown talent that we need, to what extent do you then open the gates a bit to encourage people from other parts of the world to come in and do those jobs that we can't or won't do?
Just to pick up one final point there, Terry, which Simon did allude to, and this obviously isn't so much a thing for women aged between 50 and 64, but it will be a thing for younger women than that, which is the issue of childcare. And why do you think it is that this country in particular does seem so slow to figure out that for lots of women, and this is just my own anecdotal experience talking to friends of mine, they've made the point that when they balance what they earn versus what they spend on childcare, it literally costs them money to go to work.
Oh, I mean, certainly my children are older than that now, but when my children were that age, the childcare costs were certainly more than the mortgage. They were just absolutely astronomical for sort of young age children. And, you know, obviously once they get older, that sort of tails off a bit. But it is completely unaffordable, and the costs of childcare have gone up the same as the cost of everything else has gone up. But I think there's still a massive reluctance for the government. They think that that's a luxury. That's a nice optional extra thing to have. They don't think, as you do in many other countries, that it is a necessity and it is something you need to provide cheaply and effectively and in a widespread way for women to be able to work and for fathers to be able to work as well. And we shouldn't just be something that should only fall on women.
Indeed not. We will move along, finally, for the purposes of the panel discussion, to the ethical dilemma and or vague sense of shame imposed upon the rest of us by the citizens of Tokyo. In the last year, Tokyoites have handed in to their police north of 25 million quids worth of cash and valuable items found after being misplaced by their careless and or drunk owners. The total haul of 3.7 million items included 300,000 wallets and purses, 280,000 umbrellas, 156,000 bags, 126,000 phones, 93,000 items of jewellery, and most sensationally, a box containing the yen equivalent of £227,000 in cash. I wanted to focus this item on that particular item and put that to you each in turn. Simon, you find a bag containing 227 grand on the tube. What do you do? Are you handing that in or are you keeping it?
I'm going to run a mile, frankly. I mean, what on earth is that much money doing in cash, I have to say? I mean, you're talking to the man who lost his credit card again the other day, rang the bank and was told, not again. I thought, are you really allowed to say that? But apparently I lose my credit card an awful lot. So I'm probably the kind of person who would hope that you would be honest enough to hand it in. But I just cannot imagine why anybody... I mean, I felt bad taking a few... I shouldn't say this on air. Felt bad taking a few £1,000 in cash to pay the builder the other day because I'm sure he's going to pay his VAT with it. But cash makes me really sort of spooked these days. So no, I just move away as if it was a sort of suspicious rucksack and have nothing to do with it.
I do want to come back to a point you raised there. It kind of pertains to the thing I was about to say about our previous episode. You've actually found a builder. You astound me. Do they do sheds? I will come back to you about that.
If you
that.
Pay me some cash, I will perhaps introduce you.
Terry, what would you do with 227 grand that you found on the train?
First, look around for the hidden camera. Second, look around for the... I probably would go straight to the police station or the sort of the platform guard or something because I would be really, really worried about the person who had lost it. Because I just can't imagine why you'd be carrying that amount of money around for legitimate reasons. So I would be more worried about someone tailing me down the street wanting their money back and wondering what on earth I had done with it.
So both of you
are...
This is interesting. Both of you are handing this in because you're frightened of the consequences of keeping it, neither because you think it's inherently bad just to help yourself to someone else's money.
Morality. I didn't think about that.
I generally do hand things in if I find them.
What's the most valuable thing you've ever handed in?
I can't think. I mean, it's all slightly hypothetical, isn't it now?
Knitted gloves was probably the most valuable thing because they looked so sweet. I thought there's probably some little old lady or something who's lost them and perhaps she knitted them herself and, you know, there must be a whole emotional story behind there. So I did hand them into wherever I was.
Simon, I've mostly had other people hand in stuff that I have lost. I remember going once to the sort of London Transport lost property thing, which was sounds a bit like it was in Tokyo at the time, just absolutely full, a room full of umbrellas and suitcases and phones and walking sticks and all sorts of things. You kind of thought, how on earth did you lose the wheelchair?
False I don't know teeth, how.
Yeah, all sorts of things that were found.
I was looking this up. There's been prosthetic limbs, an urn containing the cremated ashes of somebody. 800 grand a year, the London Underground clears auctioning stuff left on the tube.
Good.
Yeah. Oh. So people do hand stuff in. Someone once handed in, I had my wallet stolen and I got it back in the post. Somebody must have found it with my driving licence still in it. No money, no credit cards or anything still in it. But some anonymous person who didn't
even... Or was that the burglar, the thief who felt guilty?
Why would you do that? I don't know. Leave your fingerprints on
there. Got your cash and credit cards, but you can have your lovely wallet back. Enjoy.
I've done similar. I found a wallet on the street in a small Swedish town called Trollhättan once where I was on assignment and looked the person's name up on Facebook. It was a fairly distinctive name and sent them a message saying, I think I have your wallet. That's reasonably easily done in a small town, I think.
You see, that's your 15-minute city. You see, perhaps everyone will know everyone, sort of thing.
Exactly. Well, yeah, you see.
So I mean, at the police station, don't you?
Yeah,
that's the police station.
Apart from credit cards, have you ever lost anything tremendously valuable and had it handed back in or not?
Touch wood, I haven't. No, that's because I'm a little... Having said I'm terrible with credit cards, everything else... I am slightly OCD about. I always have to look when I get up in the tube. I always have to look and just check. And of course, that's slightly embarrassing because you quite often catch the eye of the person sitting next to you, and you think, "So I'm not looking at you because I'm trying to make eye contact with you. I'm just looking to see if I've got my umbrella with me." So yeah, it means that I don't lose many things, but I do have many regular embarrassing experiences on public transport.
So basically, to come back, both of you, to I am shocked.
Yeah, what were you talking about?
To the 220 grand in a bag. You would both do the right thing, but for the wrong reasons.
Yes, I like to think that...
I think that's quite accurate, actually. Yeah, I think I'd agree with that.
Simon Brook and Terry Stiastny, thank you both. And finally today, Monocle 24's brand new show is The Concierge. It's a weekly take on travel by road, rail, air or water, plus the latest news from the industry. The second episode will be live on Monocle 24 tomorrow at 1 p.m. London time. But before that, here is an exclusive taster. Robert Bound was joined by our travel correspondent Gabriel Lee for a look at some of the latest trends in aviation.
You are with The Concierge here on Monocle 24, and it's time to watch your altitude, the moment in the programme where we bring the very latest news from the world of air travel. And here now with the headlines, we're joined from Stockholm by Gabriel Lee, Monocle's very own transport correspondent. Gabriel, it's been ages. I hope you're jolly well there in Stockholm.
Yes, I'm very well, and I hope you are as well.
Yeah, nice to hear your dulcet tones here on Monocle 24. But we're starting with something a little bit mournful, I suppose, for seasoned plane watchers and the general public alike. The beloved Boeing 747 has bowed out. What's next for this iconic plane?
That's right. I mean, luckily, we'll still see them flying for some time, just not, you know, we know that their days are numbered in the sky now. The Boeing delivered the last one it ever built very recently. And most of these now are flying as freighters. So as passengers, you can't really, it's more and more difficult to enjoy your time on the 747. And I have to say that, you know, in terms of aircraft out there, I don't know if we'll ever see anything quite like it. These days, most aircraft are, you know, tubes with two engines, one under each wing. And it's going to keep being that way because that's sort of the most efficient way. But I think we can maybe look forward to a time when there's some kind of groundbreaking new technology coming. And there are some hints of this already that may sort of necessitate a whole new type of aircraft. You know, that people have talked about blended wings, you know, big wide things that are all wing and that people can sort of luxuriate inside in spacious lounges. Who knows?
Well, we're going to get a little bit more specific, Gabriel. Porter Airlines start commercial flights with the largest aircraft in the E-Jet E2 family. Is this the future? Maybe you could give us a little bit of background just on what that craft is.
Right. So the E2 is Embraer's updated regional jet. It's a well-liked, some would say loved regional jet because it's spacious. It flies with the economics of a regional jet, so small aircraft. It has a 2x2 seating configuration in general. In Porter's case, they only have the one type of seat. They don't have a special business or first class. So you're talking about 2x2 seating, so there's no middle seats. It's quite comfortable to fly in despite being a smaller plane. Airlines love it because it's quite cheap to operate. And the new one just has the latest efficient engines, all the latest tech to be more economical and efficient. So Porter is having a go with these as a kind of – it's a big expansion for them since they've been previously flying small props, Dash 8s, out of Toronto's Billy Bishop Airport, the closer-in airport to the city. That was kind of their USP. So now in order to bring on the E2s and sort of take on a little bit more of the Canadian and aviation market and beyond, they're flying out of Toronto's bigger international airport, Pearson, and they're offering these E2s as a kind of a way to enjoy flying again, even in economy. You know, they're offering free food, free drinks to everyone, free Wi-Fi, and they have quite a nice kind of spacious extra legroom forward cabin. So I think they're doing a nice job with what they have here.
And we queued up, Gabriel, Terminal A at Newark Airport in our introduction. What is so good? What is so exciting about Newark's new terminal?
I think the most exciting thing about Newark's new terminal is that it's not awful. You know, and that's sort of what we think of when we think of Newark Airport. And parts of Newark Airport are still awful, very dated terminals. And it's part of a sort of ongoing renaissance of all the New York area airports. Anyone who's passed through LaGuardia Airport recently may have seen that it's a completely transformed place. It used to be one of the most terrible places to fly through in the world, and now it's among the best. So Newark is sort of on this journey as well. Terminal A is the latest and greatest. It has light. It has big open ceilings. It has art from local artists. It has, you know, New Jersey focused historical displays. It has eateries that are special to New Jersey. That's also kind of interesting about it. It's not sort of billing itself as, you know, the other New York airport now. It's actually sort of trying to champion New Jersey in a sense, which is a new approach. So I think anyone passing through there will be very pleased, especially by comparison to what they would have seen in the past. Although Newark Airport as a whole still has a ways to go, and you probably find yourself connecting to some of the other terminals and having a very mixed experience doing that still.
On the line from Stockholm, that was Monocle's transport correspondent, Gabriel Lee.
And a reminder that Monocle 24's brand new travel show, The Concierge, is live every Wednesday at 1 p.m. London time and available after that wherever superior podcasts are downloaded. That is all for this edition of The Daily. Thanks to our panellists today, Terry Stiastny and Simon Brook. The show was produced by Lillian Fawcett and researched by Andre Nikolai Pamenjuan. Our sound engineer was Sarah Nicol, with editing assistance from David Stevens. I'm Andrew Muller here in London. The Daily returns at the same time tomorrow. Thanks for listening.